Blog Talk Radio.
All right, folks, we are starting on time. This is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron.
Yo, it's a tornado turning 10 miles out.
And I'm sure Psychic Tom will be on any minute. Just going to wait for him to chime in. We have a very special guest tonight. We've been promoting this show for a little while. A few days now, we knew last week we were going to have Steve Cunningham on the show, fresh off his controversial split decision loss to Thomas Adamek in their rematch of a 2008 cruiserweight fight, this time a heavyweight. And
controversial.
Yes, both fights were a little bit controversial.
Absolutely.
And, Steve could have won both of them. This time he seemed a little bit more cautious from the parts of the fight that I saw and what I read. So he definitely was scoring with that jab almost at will. And he had a very tight hands-up defense that I was very impressed with this time around. He's I noticed in the pre-fight commentary they talked about how he's got some different training staff this time around. So
a few of the things I want to discuss from tonight was and I said this a week before, or a few days, I should say, before the fight, almost 2 weeks ago. I said, going into this fight, I said, he can't get tempted. And what I think hurt him in the first fight was he was finding Adamek so easy to hit sometimes that he was standing right in his danger zone and getting caught with counters. I said, there were times like he might land, three, four, five, and six punches, and Adamek would come right back on him. He didn't let that happen this time. He was, hitting and moving. And so I want to talk about that type of strategy and why he felt that was effective. Because the thing about Adamek is, if you go back and watch the first fight, I think it was the fourth round. And I think what really cost Steve the first fight was something I perceived to be an error in the scoring. Where I know a couple of the judges gave Adamek the fourth round, 10-8, because he scored a knockdown. But if you go back and you watch that round, that was a round that Steve was actually dominating. I know he had Adamek on the ropes at one point, and he hit him with about, four or five uppercuts, and buckled his knees, and then Adamek came back and fired this wild, crazy-looking, I forget if that round was a right hand or a left hook, and knocked Steve down. Well, that's around, you could give it 10-10 even, because as Cunningham was dominating, but he did get knocked down. If you wanted to give it to Adamek, I think one of his judges scored that round 10-8. With the second round, was similar. Now, Cunningham wasn't as dominant in the second round, but he still, faced a knockdown, which in the round he was winning, now he loses on those judges' cards by 2 points, which I think is an error in scoring right there. This fight, Steve was a lot smarter. And I want to ask him about, because I know he trained for this fight. He had Nazim Richardson, who's very well known for working with Bernard Hopkins and Sugar Shane Mosley. And I'm going back for the years that I've known Nazim. I don't know him well, but I've met him, back when I was about 18, 19 years old. So I met the guy 16, 17 years ago. And obviously I followed him when he was Hopkins. He was like an assistant trainer under Billy Fisher for a long time. And I looked at some of his fighters' best performances are against guys that are more of sluggers. The place that I think are perfect examples of Bernard Hopkins versus Felix Trinidad and Kelly Pavlik, Shane Mosley against Antonio Margarito, and now Steve Cunningham in the rematch with Thomas Adamek. I think that is Nazim's, coup de grace, is developing game plans against very aggressive fighters. When he had Mosley in there with the Mayweathers and the Pacquiao's, even when he had Hopkins in there with the Joe Calzaghe's and the Chad Dawson's, his game plan didn't work as well. So I want to ask Steve about that, just to get his take on it.
Well, we'll definitely have a lot of questions for Steve and this fight. I'd like to go over some highlights of his career, too.
I also want to discuss on the article you sent a couple weeks ago about his daughter. I remember one of the reasons that I pushed to get him on the show with us about 4 years ago when he was cruiserweight champ was they had our local news station here, ABC, they did a story on his daughter and how she overcame the heart problems, and that was, he always said, was his motivation. And then that's one of the things we talked about a couple of years ago. So I'd like, for him to update the crowd on that. I'd like to also have him, update on some of the things that he has been doing as a positive member of society, a good role model for the youth, especially the inner city youth. We talked about that a couple of years ago. And he often speaks about violence and, give some of the young inner city, youths a positive role model to look up to, somebody that's not a wannabe gangster, not somebody that, a wannabe thug, wants to give them a good, clean role model to look up to.
Yeah, for sure. And we have Psychic Tom is with us. So
good evening, gentlemen. Good evening.
Tom, happy New Year. How are you?
Hanging in, bud. A little cold, but getting used to it.
Yeah,
I know. I was just out a little bit ago. It's like my hands were going numb. I'm like, I don't know if I'm all into this.
It's like 8.5 degrees up here right now.
Yeah, it's definitely a good thing none of us are in there fighting. We'd be out having to do road work in this mess. Boy, does that bring back some memories, Tom?
Oh, man. I'll tell you, Tom. It's cold. And, they had built a big levee because they had a flood back in, the early 70s. So a lot of times I would go jog on this levee because if you went to the first mile, if you went to a certain area was a mile and a half, the next bridge was 2 miles, and then obviously you would go back and pretty much double what you've already done. So I used to always go up there, and one time I'm up there jogging in mid-February, and I see some snowflakes. I'm like, yeah, no big deal. I turn around, and a snow squall appeared out of nowhere, only about a minute storm. But now I'm on this levee that's no more than 5 feet wide. So they go, oh, shit, this wind's whipping. I can't see with the snow. I'm trying to jog because I'm an Einstein. And I'm like, man, if I fall down the one way, I'm going to roll down these rocks and go right into the Susquehanna. And if I fall down the other way, I'm going to roll down and go right into traffic.
you got to get out there, there's an old cliche that getting out in the air, even if it's cold, is probably going to help your cardio a little more than staying indoors and doing it. I don't know. Maybe that's an old trainer's tale.
Yeah,
but I remember
last few days up here, I see people way older than me running down the side of the street all bundled up, and I'm like, geez, I got to get out there. This guy's doing it. This lady.
Well, I remember years ago up in Canada, Matthew Hilton was fighting someone that came from either the Caribbean or Africa somewhere. But the guy, and it was in Canada, right in the dead of winter. And I remember that the African fighter really was adverse to going out and running in the cold. It was just so unused to anything he was used to dealing with. So he did the last couple of weeks of his training indoors with the treadmill, and Atlas really felt that would make a difference in his cardio. I don't know, what do you guys think about that? Do you think there's something to that?
Running outside? Well, it depends on where you run. If you're running in the city with all kinds of fumes, maybe not.
The one thing I would say, after that incident at Lock Haven, I would kind of judge my running on how the weather would be. So we had a very large weight room there in one building's basement, and then upstairs they had a basketball court, and they had an indoor track. So it wasn't like you were in a, it wasn't like you were going into a gym area where you had bright lights and everything. This was an old building, but it also kept you averse from the weather, and you could I actually had the last 2 years of my career up there, and I would even say that I was in better shape for the most part. The running on the levee was good. It was nice when the weather was warm, because that's when all the cute girls would be up there. And if one of them was jogging, I would just follow them, and next thing I know, I'd be going 2, 3, 4 miles, and I'd feel great.
at a slow pace. Where's your priorities at, huh?
No, man,
I was the absolute slowest guy
on my team, and so these girls probably be jogging at a much faster pace than I'd ever be able to go. It actually helped me get in better shape. Oh yeah, once in a while we'd go on team runs. Thankfully, the coach didn't have us do it that often, because I used to like to run by myself. For me, that would visualize a fight. I wanted to be alone, because that's how I was going to be in the ring. I was going to be in there alone. And also the fact that I was so goddamn slow. This is even when I was in pretty good shape. I was a former defensive lineman. I'm never going to be a track runner. I have short, stubby-looking legs. I don't run fast. And I'm trying to catch. I had guys on my team that were 119 pounds, one kid 132 pounds, former track runner. I'm like, I can't keep up with you guys. You know, just go. I'll catch up with you.
Yeah.
Another VMI, I would run on the treadmill to lose weight with all my, you know, gear on. And then for all the other runs, we had Gordon Carkins was a genius with that stuff. You know, he'd have us run, I think, twice a week. We'd do 3 miles in the early morning, and he would be out there sometimes with his cigar in his mouth running with us. Just like the stereotypical Marine. And then on other days, he would have us do sprints when we were getting ready to go to the tournaments. And he'd have us run the stairs sometimes, run the track. And he had all kinds of different conditioning programs for us that really whipped me into shape, because I came down here about 30 pounds overweight. So I got in shape really fast.
One thing I really liked about doing it kind of like in a tracked area was that way I could really gauge. You have a lot of tracks where 16 laps is a mile, and so that way I could figure, okay, so 4 laps is a quarter mile, 2 laps is an eighth of a mile. So what I would do was, if I was running 16 laps, like every fourth lap, I might run backwards.
Whoa.
To help strengthen different muscles in my legs.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. You're a very aggressive fighter, but there are sometimes you're going to have to backpedal.
Sure.
I don't know if it had anything to do with conditioning, but I think there was a guy that graduated from your alma mater fighting in one of the big fights on the UFC, Tim Boach. Didn't he go to Lockhaven?
About how old is he?
I don't know. It said he was from Pennsylvania. That's what made me think about it. I swear you had said before at some point that he went to Lockhaven.
Well, like I said, he very well might have. The only reason I don't know, because maybe he was a wrestler, maybe he wasn't during my time. The two LHU alums that I know of, obviously Mike Sisnalevich, who we interviewed a few weeks ago, because Mike was there during my time. I was my last semester, because when he went out for the boxing team, I was the guy he came up to, and I quote-unquote recruited him. Then he ended up sticking with the wrestling team and getting, I think, a scholarship with them, and they didn't want him doing both. And then, obviously, Jamie Varner. And then Jamie was there after my tenure had left, so I really don't know Jamie. I really never spoke with him, but I know of him because he boxed on the LHU team, he's national champion. So, of course, you know, when guys talk about, okay, yeah, Jamie Varner, former boxer from LHU, is now fighting, you know, in cage fighting. There's also another young guy, and like I said, I really didn't know him. I only met him once or twice. And I know he's fighting for cage fighting professionally now. I don't know what league he's in, but his name's Handel Bell. H-A-N-D-E-L-L-E, and then Bell, B-E-L-L. And I met him a couple years ago. And when he first came out to the team, he was, you know, very overweight. Like, the first time I saw to me, 170 pounds. So he's lost. And he said it was the discipline that he got from first coming out to the boxing team helped him really learn how to get in shape and lose all that weight. Now he's, you know, wearing a size medium shirt and, you know, instead of, you know, double XL.
Well, I'm pretty sure I've heard them actually mention Tim Boach wrestling at Lock Haven previous UFC fights. I'll double check that, and I will do a correction next week if I'm wrong.
Tim is 31 years old. So to put you in the age range.
Okay, so you're 5 years younger than me.
Mm-hmm. He had a rough fight. I haven't seen him look this bad in a long time. He actually had a pretty halfway decent first round. He got a late knockdown. He was going against Konstantinos Filippou. And then the second round just turned into a bloody mess. He going into that round, I think it was like 21-13 significant strikes landed for Boach. And he got cut on the forehead after a headbutt, and it just went downhill from there. And I really felt bad for the guy. I mean, talk about a game changer. When you get an accidental headbutt like that, that just opens you up and, you know, the blood is running all over your face. It just has become such a pain in the ass to follow your game plan, not think about wiping it away from time.
And then also, I believe we had an eye poke there too, correct?
Yeah, you got poked in the eye.
Right. No one can say if that was intentional. I mean, you like to think it wasn't, but do you think this can set up a little controversy for a rematch?
Yeah, I think he deserves one. I mean, not only did I feel bad for him, but I think the ref felt bad for him when she finally stopped it in the third. And Kim Winslow was the referee, a former guest of ours. She had on not too long ago. All of these fights, she was a big fixture at this card, so good to see that. You know, he had such a huge amount of blood on him. He was exhausted. He seemed like he was very frustrated in the third round. And the ref just ended up stepping in and stopping it after some ground and pounds. And it seemed like Filippou even felt bad for him because he didn't really want to engage. He kept kind of looking up at the ref like, God, what are you going to do here? Come on.
Yeah.
Help to stay out. But and it was an even bloodier mess. The next fight, which unfortunately I only saw highlights of, I was in the middle of my free feed and my computer froze. So by the time I reset my computer, the main event was on. And so for the life of me, I was trying to figure out what the heck happened in the Lauzon fight. And because I reset my computer pretty fast, I figured, well, it was probably a knockout, you know. But little did I know until I read the reports afterwards, it was really the fight of the night. And a complete bloodbath after Miller threw some mean elbows in the first round and really opened up Joe's forehead. I think he ended up having over 40 stitches. Just all torn up.
Well, from the reports that I was able to get, no one in the audience was sitting down. And we did our fight of the year stuff perhaps one show too early. that's the kind of fight that you hate to see either guy lose. And
right.
And there's an old cliche that when two guys lay it on the line like that, really there's no loser. I mean, I know one guy gets the W, but you can't have two W's. But still, that was Joe will definitely be back. That's for sure.
Yeah, I think Joe going in was probably pretty safe, win or lose, you know, because he's such a big fixture and a name in the sport. He's been around since he knocked out Jens Bulver there. So he's just got super name recognition, and he's a great ambassador for the sport. He hasn't really had a string of losses at any point in his career that I can remember. And Miller, I think, was coming off back-to-back losses, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So I think he really needed the win more than Joe. But, you know, being the guy that has seen Joe on so many local events, I was, of course, rooting for him. And being that he's from Brockton, born in Brockton, and lives in Bridgewater, trains in Bridgewater there right next to where I was hanging out all the time when I lived in Mass. And, you know, I used to go to all the local circuit sites, and I'd see him coaching kids, and he definitely really cares about the local scene. So always hate to see him get dinged up at all. But I figured he would have a tough time with Miller. Miller is just kind of disappointed to me the way that he was going, and then his last couple fights just seemed like a different guy. He didn't seem as dynamic as he was. I thought he was for sure going for a title shot and going to make a lot of waves before that happened. But he's back on track now. I guess actually he didn't have a couple losses in a row. He had a loss to Nate Diaz on May 5th on UFC on Fox 3. He won against Melvin Gillard before that, and then he had a loss against Vincent Henderson before that on August 14th of 2011. And that was a unanimous decision there. Nate hit him with a guillotine choke in the second round. There with just under a minute left there, so.
Well, as far as Joe Lozon's heart, you say if he lived in the Brockton area, there must be something in the water in that town. You know, we think of the most famous name coming out of there, epitomizes Hart, and I guess Joe's some of it must have wore off on him. So
yeah, he'll be around a long time. Last time I saw him bleed like that though was when he fought Kenny Florian, and Kenny opened up the top of his head with some elbows.
Yeah.
But at least that fight, it really wasn't running into his eyes as much as it was in this fight. And to see him fight through that, you know, even come close to winning the fight by submission there at one point, it's pretty impressive. It's a Massachusetts thing, too, I've noticed, you know, going for the knee bars and the leg locks. I would notice that I would tend to see that a lot more on the local cards there than you'd see it in the UFC. So that's just something that... For some reason, it's something they work on a lot in the New England area in general, I think. But he almost had it, just couldn't pull it off. Just a tough move to get. So. And of course, we got to talk about the main event. Title changing hands there. Cain Velasquez recaptured the heavyweight title. I tuned into that fight. Actually, it was underway when I first started watching it, and it was at the end of the first round, and I just couldn't believe how bad Junior Dos Santos looked, and I did not expect him to make it through the next four rounds. And I don't know if it's Hart or just you know, a cement block for Head that let him through the fight, because he took some damage, and he just looks punch drunk throughout the entire fight. Just taking right hands like you wouldn't believe. And it seemed like whatever he threw back, it was pretty much just arm punches. And Cain just had that look about him like he knew he was going to win this fight. He knew that, you know, he wouldn't have to knock the guy out. He just basically could be like a cat in the mouse and just toy with him as long as he had to get the win. But
well,
he certainly did drop him.
Yeah, and I hate to invoke an ancient cliche, but with guys that hit that hard, maybe it's just a matter of who's going to land first. You know, because in that first round, Junior never recovered, and it almost seems like this was like one of those special NFL concussions that, you know, where the guy's sidelined for a few months and can't get back out there. Just, I mean, maybe it seems like Junior just never got his mind back. And it showed a lot of heart to keep going, but, boy, Cain was unstoppable.
Totally focused on the wrestling at one point, just decided, I'm just going to keep taking him down. Every time he stands up, I'll take him down again. And it was ironic because before the fight started, on the prelims, Joe Rogan and Dana White were doing their pre-fight chat, and of course Joe Rogan comes up with one of his magical statistics there.
13 seconds.
Yes, exactly. Junior has only been on his back for 13 seconds, and he has a hell of a jiu-jitsu game that we haven't seen yet. And we didn't see it when he was on his back for about 5 minutes of that whole fight. Where was the jiu-jitsu? I mean, I guess his brain really was somewhere else, because I didn't see him even try for a submission move, which was probably his only chance of getting taken down so many times.
Yeah, so I think where we're at now, Junior's going to have a few more wins. And, of course, Kane can't really look past Overeem either. But if we do see the third fight, you know, we're back on another cliche about the guy who loses can make adjustments. Now, I think Kane demonstrated that, you know, very accurately in the rematch. Kane had realized, I can't stand here and trade with him early on. I got to hurt him, get him down, you know. And I think in the first fight, Kane was just a little too non-aggressive. He was a little too cautious, and he didn't give him the respect this time. So the question going into the third fight, what adjustments did Junior make after a 25-minute beatdown? I mean, just a brutal street mugging. So that's the question.
Well, number one, he has to work on his takedown defense. And number two, just like we always learn first in boxing, keep your chin in and your hands up.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. We can also look at boxing, and a lot of times in these trilogies, and I'm thinking of Frazier, Ali, or Duran Leonard, for example. The first time around, it seems like the guy with the big punch has the edge, but then the second and third time, the guy who has other things in his toolbox, say like the Ward Gatti, for example. Arturo Gatti was a great boxer when he was a darn good boxer when he would get away from the brawling and the slugging. And it seems like for the second and third time around, the guy that's a little more technical maybe has the edge, so that does not bode well for Junior in a third fight at this point. Of course, anything can happen.
Apparently, he's demanding an immediate rubber match, which I don't know what kind of leverage he has to do that. It's kind of a cheating, but has said he will not fight Cormier, and Cormier just signed a new contract with the UFC before he even has his last fight with Strikeforce, so that's kind of interesting. We have a little bit of Strikeforce stuff to talk about later, but we'll definitely address that when we get there. But Kane is a training partner of Cormier, and Cormier is actually more seriously talking about going down to light heavyweight to go against John Jones.
Yeah. Well, what about Overeem? What about Overeem? Isn't that Kane's first defense against Overeem?
I'm pretty sure Overeem, didn't Overeem already sign to fight Antonio Bigfoot Silva?
Oh, yes, that's right. I'm sorry. Yeah, but he'll have to get past him. Yeah, and he can't overlook him either. But assuming he does, that seems the logical matchup to me. I mean, I can't understand where Junior's coming from demanding an immediate rematch. I mean, if it would have been a close decision, that would be one thing. This was not a close decision by any stretch.
And then we had Yushin Okami beat Alan Belcher by unanimous decision. That was a pretty one-sided fight. I don't even think I took any notes on it. It was so one-sided. Just a lot of technical gamesmanship on Yushin Okami's part, and he's really the most successful UFC fighter from Japan. A lot of these guys came over and just did not do well, but he just handled Alan Belcher pretty well there, and really just dominated the whole fight and was able to maintain control. He used a lot of wrestling, a lot of BJJ, and just basically maintained the pace through the whole contest there. And then we had probably the dud fight of the night. Derek Brunson, in his UFC debut, took on Chris Leben, coming fresh off his Drostanolone, I think it was, suspension, some kind of steroid he was on. And he looked like he needed steroids in this fight because he looked like crap. Just did not seem to want to bring the fight at all, and just looked totally out of shape. Brunson didn't look that much better because he didn't press the action and ended up being just another boring unanimous decision there. But hopefully Brunson turns it on in his next fight and Lieben snaps out of that, because both those guys could probably do better. But anyway, Eddie Wineland was also on the card. Had a pretty good fight against Brad Pickett. It was a split decision. A little controversy there. I think the crowd booed that one a little bit, but it is what it is. The bigger controversy was Jamie Varner, speaking of Lock Haven alumni, versus Melvin Guillard. I thought Guillard won. Guillard pretty much, I think there was one judge scorecard that had Guillard winning the fight all three rounds. That was the contrary. And then Varner won the other two judge scorecards. But Joe Rogan just basically said, you know, that guy needs to find a new job.
Yes.
Guillard did not look good there. He actually looked more cut than usual. He looked like he was definitely in shape for this fight. He got rocked in the first round. He was looking like he had a lot of, you know, good smooth technique leading up to that. He recovered and got through the round, but Varner just poured it on with punches at the end of the round and kind of never let up. You know, I mean, Guillard's a crafty fighter, but he just didn't have anything to match up with Varner. And he got hit by a low blow in the third round. He did stun Varner at one point and landed his jab pretty well, but Varner was just too much for him. He had the combos going. He's actually a pretty decent boxer. Definitely showed some good hands there. Actually, it was the second round where Guillard got hit by the nutshell, I think. But it was a wild finish. There was some flying knee there in the third round by Guillard. He missed out on an armbar and then reversed to side control right at the end. It's pretty intense. And Varner also had the better wrestling. He was 6-for-8 in his takedowns and just seemed to be able to get out of any kind of trouble he got in that fight. And this is the first fight I actually took notes for. Because I keep hearing you, Tom, saying, yeah, according to my notes, and I never have notes. So.
Yeah,
this time. And then we had Eric Perez versus Byron Bloodworth. That was a quick win for Eric Perez. I think they mentioned he's the first UFC fighter to win his first three fights in the octagon. And he beat Byron Bloodworth pretty bad. TKO punch in the first round, just swarmed him. Then we had a couple of Ultimate Fighter alumni. Michael Johnson was the worst I've ever seen him. He had an aggressive start, but just way too sloppy. Jury got on top, got some takedowns, and was just pretty much dominant right up until the end of the fight, so from beginning to end. And showed a lot of technical skill, and he's improved so much since the show, whereas Johnson's been really back and forth. And Jury's still technically undefeated. That's his 11th win in a row there.
He just looked flawless.
And I see him making a title run one of these days. It's definitely going to be interesting to see him fight some tougher guys that you know, I matched up with them just because they were on the Ultimate Fighter at one point. And we had Todd Duffy versus Philip DeFries, a big heavyweight fight there. That was the only other fight that ended in the first round. Every other fight went to the third round, actually. That's probably a first in the UFC. It went to at least the third round, seeing as the title fight went all five rounds. And so there was only two fights that didn't get to the third, and this is one of them. And that was also a TKO by punches in the first round. Duffy, neither guy looked very cut or physically fit, but they definitely were throwing some bombs. Just over 2 minutes in, Duffy landed a series of right hands leading up to the TKO. I think it was an uppercut that landed first, and then he threw a left to the throat, and then it was all right hands. And DeFries went down like a sack of beans there, sack of potatoes.
Well, we'll see if Dusty's back, because, you know, he was such a well-touted hot prospect a few years ago. And you remember that Mike Russo fight when he was winning on all scorecards till he ran into that right hand from hell in the last round. And I don't know if it really affected him mentally, but we'll see if he's back.
Yeah, and a couple more fights to mention here. Max Holloway beat Leonard Garcia by split decision. I think that was a controversial one, too. Garcia is just the type of fighter. It's just, he's all over the place. I guess you could call it the drunken master approach.
Good point.
He lands a lot of strikes, but he always looks tired. I thought he did enough to win this fight, but if you remember the Nam Phan fight where I think he got the nod when Nam Phan should have got the win, and then they had the rematch and Phan ruined him. But, you know, he's been on the other end of this before, so he should know what it's like. But Holloway is 21 years old. They said he's the youngest fighter in the UFC. I thought that was kind of hard to believe. I figured there'd be an 18 or 19-year-old somewhere in the mix, but apparently not. He really, you know, stepped in and did some back and forth brawling. He threw some nice body kicks in the beginning, but he kind of fell off from doing that in the later rounds. And towards the end of round two, he looked winded himself. But Garcia, I think, threw a lot more punches. He might not have landed a whole lot, but he's definitely throwing more, and he definitely looked like he was getting the better of Holloway. And then to hear that decision get read like that made me think. We should have waited to do our worst decision in the MMA. And then we had John Moraga versus Chris Carriasso. And Moraga won by submission, guillotine choke in the third round. And before we stop talking about UFC 155, I was going to say, I was going to try to see if you could guess who got paid the least amount on that card, Tom. Off the top of your head, who do you think got paid the least?
Now, are we talking about on the main card or the whole event?
Everybody.
Everybody. Okay, that would have to be, I'm going to narrow it down to one of those two last names you just mentioned.
Actually, wasn't. Those guys got paid quite a bit, actually. Guys,
really?
The last two games on the card, they were first preliminary fight on Facebook, I think.
Really?
Carriasso got paid, and Moraga got $11,000 for just the showing, and then $11,000 for the win. So he got 22 total. Mm-hmm. And then we had Garcia got $20,000 for losing. Holloway got $24,000 for winning. $12,000 to show, $12,000 to win. And we had Philip DeFries. He got $14,000 for like 30 seconds of work. And Todd Duffy got 8,000 show, 8,000 win, so $16,000. Miles Jury made $16,000 for going three full rounds there, eight show, eight win. Johnson got $14,000 in losing there. Varner got $24,000, $12,000 each win and show. Guillard got $42,000, and the lowest paid fighter on the card was Byron Bloodworth. Got knocked out TKO there. $6,000 they paid him. Can't imagine that he even paid for the trip out there and all his training expenses. But Perez got $10,000 to show, $10,000 to win for that one. Eddie Wineland made $30,000, 15 and 15. Brad Pickett made $17,000 in the loss there. Derek Brunson also made $30,000. This is a weird one, though. His breakdown was kind of different. $13,000 a show and $17,000 bonus for the win. Hmm. And Levin got $51,000 in a really sorry effort on his part. Yushin Okami got $84,000, 42 and 42, and Belcher got $37,000. Tim Boach got $37,000 as well, and Philippou in the win got $1,000 less, $36,000, 18 to show and 18 to win. Joe Lauzon got $27,000, while Jim Miller got $82,000, 41 to show, 41 to win. I think they also got Fight of the Night bonuses, so you got that on top of that. And finally, the main event, Junior Dos Santos got $400,000 to get his ass kicked, while Cain Velasquez got $200,000. $100,000 purse and $100,000 win. So that's the UFC pay structure for that event.
So it sounds like it sounds like minimum wage is $6,000.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I've seen $3,000 and $4,000 for some fights on the preliminaries, but I guess for a pay-per-view situation, that's pretty much the low as you go most times. Then, of course, they have the unpublished locker room bonuses, as they call them. And there's situations where they get the pay-per-view bonus money, a percentage of the pay-per-view, exactly how much some of these guys make. But it seems hard to believe that, you know, even in the main event guys, maybe if you add in their sponsorship, they're getting paid $1 million in some situations. But I don't know. It just doesn't seem like they're paying as much as boxers. Even though they're doing very well for them. And another story here in MMA before we switch over to a little couple boxing pieces here. Dan Severn has finally retired after notching his 101st win at 54 years old. He retires with a 101-19-7 pro MMA record. We had a guest on months ago here who gave him, I think, I don't know if it was his 19th loss or 18th or 19th, but I think it was one of those two. Heavyweight from Massachusetts there. I'm drawing a blank on his name.
You know, Severn had been trying for that 100th win for, I think we're going back a year and a half. And I remember seeing his one of his attempts to get his 100th win. And it kind of brought back some bad memories to me of that movie with Anthony Quinn, Requiem for a Heavyweight. Remember that one? No, I don't think Severn is anywhere near that mentally. But it was sad just seeing the venue that the former UFC heavyweight champion, the super fight champion, the tournament winner, you know, at the heights that he had been to, and to see him, you know, no knock on any tournament, but I mean, you know, it comes down to when there's a couple hundred people in a small arena somewhere, and then to get knocked out the way he did from a head kick, and he seemed like he was out for a good couple minutes, and he was desperate to get that 100th win. So I don't know how many I haven't checked his record to see when that happened, but At least he got 101, went out as a winner, I hope.
Yeah, that's good for him. I never really heard of the guy he beats to get 101 to win, but whatever it takes.
A win's a win.
54 years old. I don't think we're going to see many MMA fighters fight till they're 54. I think other than him, the oldest guy that I know of to compete at that level still was Herschel Walker. It looks damn good for being in his 40s. I got into boxing. I know I sent both of you guys this story. Pretty funny little side note here. Morristown. This, I mean, you think Jersey Shore makes people from New Jersey look bad. This guy, he apparently was drunk, and he showed up at this place called the Grasshopper off the Green. And the bouncer called the police because after he was asked to leave, he returned, and then he refused to leave again. When the cops showed up and told him to go away, this 21-year-old kid became argumentative with the officer, bumped into his chest, and yelled into his face. This guy Hayes was then arrested for defiant trespass, and during the process, he told the officer that he was going to lose his job and that he had a great lawyer who will beat this charge. When Hazel arrived at the police station, he refused to be processed or searched until his lawyer responded to the station. So he was placed in a holding cell, and that's when he began banging on the door and screaming for his lawyer. When one of the officers watched on a video monitor, Hayes wrapped a whole roll of toilet paper around his right hand in an apparent attempt to make a boxing glove.
and then punched the cell door. Hayes was later released when his mother picked him up.
Oh,
and his lawyer showed up. I love that last box, you know. It's like, you know, you want to end for effect in a story like that. And, you know, it's just basically saying, yeah, this guy who was screaming for his lawyer ends up leaving with his mom.
Kind of, and you know, the sad thing, I forwarded that to a few of my friends, and they're saying, yeah, that reminds me of, and they're like, I got three different names back. You know, it shows you the crowd I run with. Jeez.
Well, it makes me think, you know, is toilet paper good for hand wraps? Maybe I should start trying that.
Unless you had Charmin, like, extra thick or something.
I would probably just get pissed because it would keep breaking off when I'm trying to wrap it, you know, but I guess he must have wrapped it the wrong way. It's kind of tough to wrap it the right way with a roll of toilet paper. Anyway, one guy leaves the sport, another guy comes back. Mirko Krokop has successfully made his return to the MMA arena, and he faced a guy named Shinichi Suzukawa over in Japan. And Krokop came out aggressive with his trademark stand-up and then decided to pull out an armbar and finish off his pro wrestler opponent in a successful return. And basically, he was 4-6 in the UFC and decided to call it quits after a tough loss. And now he's made a victorious return here. Another boxing story related to police as well. Austin Trout was trying to have a nice meal at a taco joint on New Year's Day when a fight broke out in the restaurant. Police quickly arrived on the scene, and rather than try to decipher who was involved, they just handcuffed everybody, Trout included. And the boxing champ told the El Paso Times what happened. He said, the police officer said I was involved, and I told him, I don't fight for free. It's funny, they arrest everyone who wasn't involved in the fight. The police officer said I was intoxicated. I told him I wasn't. He said he could smell it on my breath, and I asked to take a breathalyzer, and he said he didn't have to give me one. They just held me for the required time. I paid a booking fee, and I was released. It was all just a mistake. So, No Doubt is his nickname. There's no doubt he was innocent in this one. Nonito Donaire Jr. is an advocate for cleaning up the sport of boxing. He's been for a few years now on that vein. And he is the first boxer to submit himself to 24/7, 365 random blood testing conducted by the VATA, which is the Voluntary Anti-Doping Agency. Basically, he's had some increased talks and is concerned with about his fight with Rigondeaux. And he's also looking at the fights with Lamont Peterson and Andrew Berto. Both were caught with illegal substances in their system by the ADA. And he wants this Rigondeaux fight to include the same thing. He says, I would like to do that, especially because people have been asking for it. Random is good, so we can help clean boxing's reputation. If they want to request me to fight them, then I have a request for them to fight fair. It's an even trade. So we'll see if that Guillermo Rigondeaux fight comes through and if that becomes a necessary demand for that fight to happen. We'll see. And I don't know why I never saw this in the boxing links, but apparently I've looked on BoxRec, and Floyd Mayweather Jr. is slated to fight Robert Guerrero now on May 4th. I don't know how this flew under the radar, and it's not everywhere, all over the place, but apparently it's
official. Tonight we're talking about fights that were coming up on, they're doing it on May the 4th. Because I remember reading Canelo Alvarez is fighting on the card, and I have BoxRec up now, so I'm going to pull up who he slated to fight. And then they said, when I was reading the article the other day, I forget if somebody posted it on Facebook or something like that. Jorge Alvarez set to fight on May 4th. They said, we'll be on the undercard of the Floyd Mayweather fight. I said, oh, shit, I didn't even know Mayweather was signed. Then they said, likely against Robert Guerrero. So why don't we go back to straight off? I actually had January 4th up, so I'm just going to change January to May and see what we got. Okay, here's more of this. On Boxrec, has Floyd Mayweather and Robert Guerrero, and then has Saul Alvarez, and it doesn't have an opponent. I'm trying to remember who they had him listed against the other day. Unfortunately, I am. Let me see if Google has anything on it. Also, do want to mention, and I will get in depth of this in a few minutes, but we were trying to fly, you know, the flight starts tomorrow night. Let me just see until.
Yeah, I don't know why that didn't make any headlines, that that fight is signed. You would think that it would be everywhere.
And I knew that it was, a pretty decent name fighter. And here it is, Yahoo Sports from 2 days ago. Saul Alvarez, the fighter we were just talking about, Austin Trout.
Yeah.
But all it says here is... So, Alvarez, Austin Trout, sent for Mayweather pay-per-view undercard, ? And then from recent reports, all sides are pointing to Saul Canelo Alvarez taking on the challenge of Austin Trout this coming May 4th underneath a likely Floyd Mayweather-Robert Guerrero main event, the MGM Grand.
Right. Interesting.
For the first thoughts, do either one of you guys see Guerrero giving Floyd any trouble at all?
Any trouble? Yeah. Enough trouble with a win? No. I'd love to see him win, though. It's not that I would think that he would have an easy time of it. It would have to be a real miracle for him to do it, but his character is so solid. Yeah, he's such a good guy. Love to
see
it happen. Realistically, I think he would have to really change his whole style to really compete and beat Mayweather. But you never know. You know, Mayweather's been distracted. It could be a low point in his career. It could be a real tough fight for him. He could be overlooking him. It could be a bad day.
Well, what do you think, Tony?
I lost my train of thought. Okay. So, hold on. I'm drawing a blank right now.
Mayweather and Guerrero.
Who's going to
win?
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. I haven't put this fight into my computer yet. You know, my computer...
Does not compute.
The little key brain that resides in between my ears... So what will happen is, and Rich, I've done this in the past, I sit down and I put all the facts in, the styles, the common opponents, if there are any, strengths, weaknesses, best fight, age, all that, and then I let my little pea brain compute something. I would say right now, before I really analyze it, my first gut instinct is Mayweather by unanimous decision. But here's the thing is, if you go back and you look at Mayweather for the past 5 years, since his fight with Ricky Hatton, who was basically really just a limited fighter. Ricky was a smaller fighter. He was very popular, but if you go back and you really look at him, he was really... average at best. So you have the big win over Hatton. Then he retires. He comes back and he fights a great fighter, Juan Manuel Marquez, but a fighter whose style was made to order for him. Marquez is naturally a smaller guy. Marquez is naturally a counterpuncher. So Marquez, whose strength would be trying to counterpunch and box with Mayweather, was just too small and too slow. Tailor-made for him. Then you have the fight after that, he fights Sugar Shane Mosley. Everybody's thinking, well, shit, Mosley just destroyed Antonio Margarito. Maybe Mosley's got something left. No, that was the case of Mosley finding a guy tailor-made for him, and the fact is that he was just too old and his reflexes were too gone to fight Mayweather. Steps in against Victor Ortiz. Now he's got a young guy, a big guy, a strong guy, but a guy that was mentally weak and who has a weak chin. Once again, tailor-made. So, and then his fitness test came from Miguel Cotto, who we can clearly see is over the hill. Cotto bloodied his nose up and had that fight even after 8 rounds. So could there be some chinks in the Mayweather armor? Could be. Is Guerrero the type of guy that can expose them? Absolutely. We are talking about a guy that's still young, still relatively fresh, hasn't fought a lot of wars. He's a southpaw, and he's filling out. It's not like he's jumping in weight to jump in weight. He's legitimately growing into that from 130 pounds. Now, you can say he's a legitimate 147-pounder. Once again, he is a southpaw. He can. I think for the first few rounds, he is going to give Mayweather some hell. But then when all the chips are laid out, you're still looking at probably the best fighter of this generation, and he will find a way to win. I don't think he'll knock Guerrero out. I don't think he'll dominate him. But I think it'll be similar to the Cotto fight where the last four rounds, similar to the De La Hoya fight where the last four rounds, the championship round, is where Mayweather will win that fight.
Well, there you have it. That's the Rain Man's conclusion so far.
I had that little bit of a brain freeze. And like I said, I literally, when you asked that, I was like, oh my God, we were just talking about Mayweather. And I was like, who's he fighting again? That's the effect of me taking sometimes too many punches. And once my little pea brain flipped on, I go.
All right. Well, now we're gonna go into a different gear here. We're gonna bash Dana White a little more, like we haven't bashed him enough. But he's been all over the place this week since last Thursday. We didn't get a chance to put this in the show, but last Thursday there was an article about his statements that they're completely off the wall. I mean, if what he says is true, they ought to change UFC to USC, the ultimate stoner championship, because he actually went out there and said publicly that if he did year-round a random drug testing of all 475 contracted fighters under the UFC label, that about 400 of them would be busted for marijuana. So it's like a 85%. It computes right out to about 85% of the whole league, he thinks, would get busted for marijuana.
Wow.
Which blows my mind, because, I mean, how do you expect all these guys to fight for you when you're basically calling them a bunch of stoners with no proof? I don't know. I don't know where he's coming from there. But apparently that's his big beef, why he doesn't want to implement random drug tests. Sign up this company to do testing. There's a whole shitload of things that would come about. He also said the goal of Sergeant Spencer here on testing would be to eradicate PEDs, but said it would serve a vastly different purpose. Everybody thinks that if you did random testing, you'd catch so many guys on PEDs. No, you'd catch more of the guys on marijuana. That's where you'd really bust a lot of guys. We have 475 guys under contract, and probably 400 of them would be out with marijuana. And this article makes a very interesting point, not one that I would have come to the conclusion of. I would have hammered him more on the fact that there's no way 85% of the guys in the U.S. are smoking weed. But this guy hammers him on another thing. He says it would be true if there were those 400 fighters to be caught with marijuana in their system as they are training for a match. But again, it wouldn't apply if the UFC hired a company that religiously followed the WADA code and randomly tested its athletes. In that system, an out-of-competition positive test for marijuana would be meaningless. But White says there are no easy answers, and there have been performance enhancers around as long as the athletes have been competing for money. But it's just a really lame explanation. I mean, I think he just doesn't want fights to be canceled. I mean, it's all about the money in his eyes. And he doesn't want the exposure of what random drug testing would show as far as the rampant use of performance-enhancing drugs other than marijuana. So he just wants to play a little a dog and pony show, I guess, and try to make it look like the real story is marijuana and get people talking about that instead of the more controversial thing, which is, why are you letting guys get in the cage with other guys when they have a severe advantage because they're doing these performance-enhancing drugs and not getting caught in the regular Nevada Athletic Commission or whatever athletic commission is testing them. Now, enough about that one. But another way Dana White made himself look pretty stupid this week is there was an article that came out where he was basically saying, I'm so glad it's over as far as the demise of Strikeforce. For months, he's kind of dodged anything to do with the running of Strikeforce, repeatedly saying that he doesn't run that promotion. Also saying that it's going to be business as usual when they first bought the promotion. And now there's an article saying that the whole Showtime debacle where they stopped the contract, they decided not to renew the contract with Strikeforce, was Dana White's problem. He's the one that could not get that deal done because Showtime apparently had a problem with him specifically. But now he's saying what has happened to the fighters of Strikeforce is horrible. The way this thing went down, what's happened to these guys have been very patient, and I feel sorry for them, and I'm just happy they're coming into the UFC now. What's happened over there has been completely bullshit. The UFC insists that despite pushback from those that believe the company always intended to shut the doors on Strikeforce, he got involved with that intentions. The deal just never came together the way he had hoped, and now they just had to pull the plug. And he said, I see a lot of shit on the internet, people saying this is exactly what we knew was going to happen. They bought it to bury it and all this stuff. Any of you guys that were around me during that time, that was absolutely not the plan. I was pumped up about it and looking forward to getting into it, but no, it never happened. I'm just happy it's over. So that's the story that was on the internet a few days ago. Now we fast forward to today. Actually, January 2nd, that was yesterday, right? Yeah, that was yesterday. Yesterday on MMA Weekly, big article, Dana White apologizes to Strikeforce fighters. I'm really disgusted by what happened. So a few days ago, you're happy. Now you're disgusted, okay? And we're supposed to believe that you didn't plan all this, that it wasn't supposed to go down this way. I mean, people were basically clamoring for the UFC to fold Strikeforce in there just so we could see these fights. And we're going to see now that some of these more stars are going to come over. But some interesting points are made in the comments of this story where people say, well, if you didn't suck up all the good fighters from over there and move them over to the UFC before you folded it, it probably wouldn't have got folded in the first place. But anyway, his apology now, a few days after he said he was happy, He says, what's happened to those guys over in Strike Force, it's terrible. It's really bad what happened to them over there, and it makes me sick. And when he fell out with Showtime officials, White removed himself from the situation almost entirely, but he still feels a strong sense of responsibility toward the fighters that suffered through the situation. I should probably sit down with all of them, he said. I apologize for everything that's gone on for the last 8 months. I'm really disgusted by it. And as is well known, the UFC did sort of destroy Pride when they promised they were going to have Super Bowl events between the UFC and Pride. And just basically, I think it wasn't even a couple months after they acquired them, they made the excuse that, oh, we couldn't make a TV deal in Japan, so we have to fold it. And basically, the only acquisition that the UFC has made over the years and kept as a going concern for a decent amount of time was WEC. And they recently even folded that into the UFC. And basically, the reason why that worked was because it was lower weight classes, which we didn't see a lot before that. But it did pretty well. I mean, they had everything going on a different channel and still did pretty well. It really did look like a totally separate entity. Whereas once the UFC got a hold of Strikeforce, it just never seemed separate at all. It seemed like it was just basically a minor leagues of the UFC. And we had guys who were asked to go from the UFC to Strikeforce, didn't want to go. They couldn't get a fight for Cormier. And just ridiculous amount of maneuvering there to make it look like they wanted to keep it going. But I don't believe for a second that Dana White is not dancing on the grave of Strikeforce right now.
Sure.
Before the final event happens on January 12th. And basically his last quote in this story is, it won't happen again. The shit is over now. It just blows my mind to see them, a lot of the media out there just take everything that Dana White says as gospel and not call him out on these type of contradictions. But maybe I'll have to write an article about it.
Okay.
From syndication. So that's our Dana White bar. If you want to check those links out. And one of them is on MMA Weekly. I'm not sure which the other one, where the other one came out on. But speaking of Cormier, Daniel Cormier, 10-0. He's going to be fighting Deion Staring, 28-7 at the final Strikeforce event on January 12th. And according to MMAJunkie.com, the Strikeforce Heavyweight Grand Prix champion signed a multi-fight contract with the UFC this past weekend. And although he says he has signed a shorter contract, Cormier said he would still like to have a shot against former UFC heavyweight champion Frank Mir, who was supposed to face Cormier back in November until he pulled out of the fight due to a knee injury. Mir does owe Cormier a fight, especially after pulling out of their rematch or their match in November. Strikeforce champion also said that he would move back and forth between the heavyweight and light heavyweight divisions. Basically, like I said earlier, his American Kickboxing Academy teammate is Cain Velasquez, and wouldn't be a good idea for them two to fight. According to each of them, they said they do not want to fight each other. So Cormier may really have to go down to 205 just to get a title fight that he wants. But, Velasquez is a champion. And of course, we have the ultimate between Chael Sonnen and John Jones coming up pretty soon, I think at the end of this month. And whoever wins that fight at the end of that would probably be in a position to face Cormier if he could get down to weight that fast. We'll see. Another big criticism of the UFC coming from Korea, Road FC CEO Moon Hung Young has described Ultimate Fighting Championship as being like a cancer of Korean MMA. And he is presumably unhappy about seeing his bantamweight champion, Kyung Hope Kang, sign with the world's leading mixed martial arts promotion immediately after he won a 135-pound Grand Prix at Road FC 8 this past summer. and the man behind Korea's biggest MMA promotion, which already shares fighters such as Soo Chul Kim and Bae Young Kwon with the other organizations in the 1OC network, is clearly unhappy about seeing one of his best fighters sign exclusively to the UFC without Road FC receiving any compensation. And basically, he put out a press release about the whole situation, and he claimed it's just like a robber. If UFC want to globalize MMA, UFC must clarify the sports, it's professional or amateur. For example, in the Pro Football League, when a player transfers to another team, it will be the negotiation between the two teams which the player transfer from and to, and will be a transfer fee too. UFC has excluded the existing system standard, just the acquired fighters, and tried to globalize itself. To snatch a star fighter who has been produced by other promotions with their efforts is not professional and even doesn't deserve amateur level. Just a vulgar way to get the fighter. And if Road FC is beaten by UFC, then there will be no improvement in Korean MMA and much less opportunities for fighters will lead to less production of good talent at all. As a result, with a long-term perspective, UFC's business style has bad influence on not only Korean MMA, but also for the improvement of most concentrating. So it sounds like he's just pissed because he didn't get paid. That is what it is. Another little interesting story here. Chris Lyle is talking about back after a situation where a fighter pulls up and moves him. A pretty nice exit out of the UFC by beating up Dan Hardy at UFC Live 5 in August of 2011. But he's not counting out a return at some point. He did leave the sport to spend more time with his family. He's 38 years old. But he has left the door open here. As you know, there always is an interest in fighting again, and it never really left me. But the reason I kind of retired was I just wasn't putting enough time in with the family, and I just can't commit myself to that kind of training anymore where I'm gone at all times, every time, so you never know. I always say if maybe something came up with a guy I want to fight, something happens to his opponent like a week out, I might take that, so that could happen. Barring that, no, I'm not. I'm not going back to training full time. Should a hypothetical return to competition take place, Lido would obviously prefer to fight an opponent who matches up with him stylistically. And he mentions specifically former Strike Force champion Nick Diaz or former interim UFC welterweight champion Carlos Condit. And he says, no, I don't really care about it being a title fight. It's more about the type of person, you know, I want. There's a few guys, you know, man, like a Nick Diaz type guy who I like Nick. I wouldn't really want to fight him, but maybe something like who I like the way he comes forward to fight you, to punch you in the face and take you, go out and just go the whole time and doesn't really care about it. It's just that's the way I am. So guys like that, you know, I always like the way certain guys like that fight. Maybe like a Carlos Condit, something like that. Those type of fighters interest me. But, you know, those are kind of big fights that I don't see happening unless their opponent pulls out at the last minute and they need somebody. And actually, Lionel and Diaz fought once before at IFC WC 17 in July of 2002. Diaz walked away with unanimous decision victory that night, and over 10 years later, and with two much more developed skill sets, a Lionel versus Diaz rematch would certainly be a fascinating match. Diaz has bigger fish to fry, though, as he's currently scheduled to face DSP for the UFC Welterweight Championship at UFC 158 in March. So, probably not going to happen, but he is definitely leaving the door open there. Another Nick Diaz nugget. I did not read the complete story. It's a headline in the MMA links today that Diaz is not returning Dana White's texts or phone calls. There's been another situation where he ducks out on the press conferences. And he has a documented case of, anxiety. So it's one of those situations where he really is afraid of crowds. And I've seen him, I mentioned this on the show before, I saw him on MMA Uncensored with his brother. And you could tell, you know, just being on camera. He doesn't have an easy time of dealing with people in general. He was like grabbing his knees and moving his hands up and down his legs. He looked very nervous. And he obviously has some kind of issue there, which is apparently why he smokes marijuana.
You know, but I find it amazing that he can walk into a cage in front of an arena of thousands of people with God only knows how many watching on pay-per-view, perform superbly, act normal, act relaxed, give an interview afterwards, and yet he can't get on a stage, and it's amazing. To me, it's just, I'm just kind of at a loss for words, but I know that a lot of times, sometimes the skill sets don't transfer. Like I've had some of the guys that I've trained with, when I was doing stand-up comedy, and they said, I could never get up on stage like that. Well, to me, it's here these guys walk into a ring or a cage. What's harder than that? I mean, if they've got the stones to do that, I think that they could do anything. It's amazing to me.
Yeah, the only similar situation I could point to is kind of embarrassing because I hate to admit it, but when I was with my last girlfriend, she used to watch The Bachelor a lot. Or The Bachelorette, I think it was, where, you know, all these guys are trying to compete for one girl. And, of course, I'd have to watch it with her. And, I was watching one of the episodes, and here's this guy. He's, you know, a big star on a TV, reality TV show. And he's got the same thing. He's very anxious, you know, and it didn't look like he had a reason to have any kind of, you know, being afraid of people. He seemed like he was fine. But, you know, inside, he was really bugging out every time he was in a public situation. And he, like, sort of confessed to that situation on camera to the girl, and I guess it got him some brownie points. But, you know, it was kind of hard to believe. But people have these little nuances, psychological situations where they can't deal with reality for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
But they can go out and they can be in situations where you would think that they don't have that problem, but, you know, they just learn to hide it well, I guess.
Yeah, and I would think if you have the discipline to apply yourself to something as demanding as boxing or MMA, you could come up with a plan to, you know, you could get a coach. I mean, yeah, you could get the, you know, I hate to say therapist, but I mean, just come up, just get some way of dealing with it. That is, I don't know, I just kind of at a loss for words for it.
All right, well, we have just connected Steve Cunningham. How's it going, Steve?
Hey, what's going on? I'm all right.
Hey, Steve, how you doing?
Good. Y'all hear me?
Yep, we can hear you good. Can you hear
us? I'm doing all right, you know. So?
All right, Steve, so obviously we got to talk about the big fight there. Between Adam Ecker, it was obviously something you've been looking forward to, rematch from 2008. What were your thoughts on the fight?
I mean, you know, my thoughts on the fight was, you know, I won a unanimous decision at the end of the 12th round, and, you know, the first score gets called, you know, the draw, that kind of disgusted me, you know? Then the... Then we hear, hold up, you know, they got to redo the scores because, you know, 115-115, that's basically impossible, you know, on a scorecard that hasn't been had any knockdowns or anything. So, I mean, really, that's impossible. So we're like, all right, you know, I'm saying to myself, they're about to get it right, you know, and they call Adamick the winner, you know, and it's, you know, you got the Pennsylvania Commission in there adding up numbers or just putting numbers wherever, you know, right there on television. I mean, this is ridiculous, man. It's very ridiculous.
And we also know that Adamick's promoter, I think during and after the fight, both times, thought that you won the fight and said that his fighter got a Christmas present. So that must infuriate you even more.
Yeah, no doubt. This whole situation, it's good and it's bad. You know, the good was America finally got a chance to see Steve Cunningham. You know, they see me for who I really am, you know, a boxer puncher, you know. I put on a great show. We got 3.2 million views, I heard. It was on NBC, the first network the first fight on network television for NBC, the second one, you know, in 20 years. CBS had one on, I think, a week before. And, you know, we got a chance to basically right or wrong. You know, I felt that I messed up in that first fight with Tomas Adamic. You know, I saw where I messed up at. I felt my thing with the first fight was, you know, I was a world champion. This is my first time fighting back in America on you know, it was on the Versus Network, so sort of on television. You know, I wanted to make a statement. We felt we could knock Adamic out, and coming off the 12th round stoppage of Marco Huck in 07, we, you know, with Adamic being my next fight, felt we could do that also. And you know, to my surprise, 3 knockdowns later, I lose my belt. So looking at that fight, knowing what I did wrong, this was a great opportunity to right or wrong. But then on the other side, this decision, man, the decision just stinks to high heavens. I mean, I'm still racking my brain, like, what can I do? Because this is, it's so wrong and it's so blatant. Everybody sees it so wrong, but it still is one of them things, well, it's boxing. And it's like, that sucks, man. That's disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they figure out a way to.
When you had the first fight with Adamic back in 2008, it was actually a few months after we had interviewed you for the first time on here. And what Rich and I did was we had another guest on our show that night, and we actually did the play of that fight over our airwaves. And I remember, and I still said to Rich, and I even said it to a few friends of mine that I watched the fight with 2 weeks ago, I said, I felt the one mistake that hurt you in that first fight is there were certain times you were doing so well and you were finding Adamic so easy to hit. And the one that really popped in my mind the fourth round, I think you had him on the ropes, and you hit him with about 5 or 6 or maybe 8 straight uppercuts. And then he countered and it was one of the 3 knockdowns. Now, one thing I did say before we you know, got on the air tonight was talking about scoring. And I said, there is a situation where even though a fighter gets knocked down in a round that he was dominating, the judge should not have scored that in 8. That should have been a 10-10 round because in 2 minutes and 50 seconds, you had dominated that round. And
at least score it a 9-9 round. You know what I'm saying? It should have been a tie round.
Right, exactly. And I remember going into this fight, and it was actually kind of fortunate. I was working that Saturday at a friend of mine's business where we have a trailer with a TV. We don't get the best reception on live events, but when my shift ended at 5, literally you were starting to walk to the ring. I said, well, I'm not going to be able to make it home in time, so I'm going to stay here and try to walk it. I watched it with 2 friends of mine. And one, actually, gentleman was on the phone with me tonight. I told him I was interviewing you. And I said, do you have anything you want to ask? And he basically said, I don't know what else I could ask him, except for how bad does he got to beat him the next time to get the decision.
Exactly.
And when we watched it, I remember turning to these 2 guys, because they watched some fights. And I said, what we got to see here, and I started laying out a game plan, and which actually turned out to be what you were doing. Boxing, using a jab, hitting him 1, 2, and 3 times, and then not standing in front of him for the counter punches, which was kind of what you in the first fight. And after it was over, I turned to these guys and I said, 8-4, 116, 112. And they looked at me and they nodded in agreement. And when the first judge, Michael Buffer announced the first one, he goes, 115, 115. And they looked at me and I looked at them. And then when they made the second announcement, which they announced you as the winner, then I said, Michael Buffer just made a mistake, or there's a mistake here. Because in a fight like that, if you want to draw first, then the next 2 cards are always announced as the winner. I said, if there's a split draw, the draw is going to be the last one scored, or the last one announced.
Exactly.
And then when they said, no, we had a mistake in the scoring, I thought they were going to come out there and right the wrong, not make the wrong even more wrong.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what we, I mean, you know, I was getting my gloves taken off, but, and truthfully, I'm going to tell you the truth, when the first scores were being, when they started reading the scores, I didn't care. because I, you know, there, you know, I, it was a unanimous decision. Like I said, going back to the to my corner after the 12th round, after the bell sounded for the 12th round, there was no way in the world you could tell me I didn't just win a unanimous decision over this guy. So while I'm getting my gloves taken off, I'm just like, yeah, you know, I'm expecting to hear Steve Cunningham. But then they read that draw, and I'm like, okay, you know, me fighting in Europe has shown, you know, it's one thing me and my team, we always say, and we always say that there's always an in-house judge. There's always a judge in the pocket that's going to score it for the home country dude, you know, or the home team dude. When I beat Marco Hupp, you know, I stopped him in the 12th round. I'm beating this guy from round four on. And one of the judges had him winning. So, you know, we expected. I mean, that wasn't surprising to hear that first score. But then that second score came out, which was me. And I'm like, okay, that's right. But then the third one was bananas.
Well, I'll tell you this, Steve. Next time, I guess you got to slow your punches down because I guess you're punching too fast.
No, you know. It must have been something. It's even, like, I posted on Facebook, you know, a few days after the fight, and I said, you know, either the judges were either, one, they were incompetent, they don't know what they're doing, you know what I'm saying, or, two, they're on the take. Somebody gave them some money because they scored the 10th round, which was probably the most blatantly obvious round for me. They scored that round for Adamic, those two judges who scored the fight for Adamic. And that right there is worthy enough to go to court, you know, something, you know, to do something on, because that is blatant bogus, you know, bogacity.
Well, it seems like, you know, that's the big problem with boxing is there's no recourse for situations
exactly.
Like this. I mean, had the Pacquiao versus Bradley situation, and it made a big stink. People talked about it for weeks, but nothing got done. And they didn't even force a rematch in that situation.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, the thing with boxing also, you got the betting. So you take my fight with Adam or Bradley's with Pacquiao, and Bradley's the mad underdog, I'm the underdog. The underdog wins, let's say 4-1, you know, he wins, everybody gets paid that night, but then you go back and you go to court or you do whatever, and you award the proper winner, Pacquiao or Cunningham, then what happens with the betting money? You know, see, this is bigger. You know what I'm saying? This is way bigger than just the decision. People got to realize when money's involved, it's corrupt. It's very easily corruptible, and it's just ridiculous. You know, I heard, you know, and I've heard my share of rumors, and I heard one of the rumors was, you know, Adamic, you know, the betting on Adamic, and they had to switch the scores for Adamic. You know, it's just a lot of stuff. But, I mean, flat out, the judges were wrong, and something needs to be done now for boxing instead of saying, well, that's what boxing is. No, that's not what boxing is. That's called corruption right there.
Yeah, and especially when it's on such a grand stage like that, they're trying to get it back on network TV and get people to like it and embrace it. When you have a situation like that, I mean, how many black guys does boxing need before they send it to the hospital?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it's obvious boxing's got millions of eyes because I think half a million are black right now. I mean, and the thing is, this is the crazy thing about our sport, though. You know, boxing can have something like Steve Cunningham, or okay, let's say boxing can have a Manny Pacquiao in a Bradley fight, but then turn around and have a Rios Abril fight, you know? So the black eye kind of goes away. People forget about the black eye. And I mean, that's what happens. I mean, look at, I can only use me for a main example. You know, this affected my life. You know, this is my future. You know what I'm saying? This is the heavyweight title, you know, a tournament to get to the heavyweight title, so that's big money. So this is my life, my future for my family, and it means a lot to me, so I'm going to keep speaking on it, you know. So on Facebook, I put out there, you know, probably for the past, you know, since the fight's happened, all my posts have been about the fight, and you've got people, oh, shut up, it's over now, you know, and it's like, no, it's not over, you know, this is over, but it's not over, you know, this happened to me, this isn't just a game I'm playing here, you know, on Xbox, and I lose, and I move on. No, this is my life, my career, my future for me and my family.
Well, I'll say this much, Steve. Steve, you really picked up a lot of fans. And I've been all over the internet on a lot of forums. And I know, it, you know, it's kind of hard to put a silver lining on this because when I heard that draw, that was bad enough. But then I could only imagine how bad you felt. I mean, it was just, but I'm telling you, if there's any good thing about this, you followed your game plan exactly the way you wanted to. I think your lateral movement, it not only did your lateral movement work good, but I think you controlled the range. You know, you had that jab going, because I remember after the fourth round, showed a close-up of Thomas, and he was bleeding a lot from that jab that kept popping. I mean, you were cooking with that jab, and I think that you were either in close enough that he couldn't do a lot of damage, or you were just outside of the punching range just as you should have been. But I have a question for you. It seemed like you were working the body a little more than he was. Now, you know, it's boxing 101 that when you're up against a slick boxer, you want to work the body to try to slow him down, and yet I didn't see Thomas even committed to much of a body attack. Now, do you think, were you anticipating a body attack from him? Because I know your defense was good. You seemed to have your elbows in pretty tight. So did you actively plan on shutting down his body attack?
Well, it's two things. That's a great question. Here's two things about that. One is Tomas Adamek is just a puncher. Flat out, simple, 100% he's a puncher. Headhunter, puncher. We haven't ever really seen Tomas go to the body a lot. You know, he hasn't had to. You know, he's a puncher. He'll hurt guys to the head. You know, he knows he's very strong. All he is a puncher. Him and Roger Bloodworth, they've been telling people, and truthfully, we believe they've been pulling the wool over boxing's eyes for years. Oh, Tomas is a great boxer. He's got so much good head movement, his speed. Me and my wife read this on Fight News, you know, we're reading this, and we're just sitting here like, yeah, right. Like, who's writing this? Why are they putting this out? It's obvious. He's not. He's not a boxer. He fights bigger guys. He fought Chris Areola, Grant, all these bigger guys. Yeah, he's going to be faster. Look faster. But when he fights a real boxer, he looks like an old man, and that's what he did. Now, the second part to that answer is, if you see, he tried to do what I did to him. You know, I was jabbing. I was sticking my jab in his gut, you know, hearing every chance I could get, you know, take the wind out of him. And he tried to do it to me, and I blocked it with my elbows. And he tried to throw a right hand to my body, and I blocked it. So it was basically discouraging him. He's like, wow, this dude's defense is pretty on point tonight. I can't get in the body. And when you go into the body like that, you're risking getting countered anyway to the head. So we basically shut his body attack down.
Yes, exactly.
But he did try in the later rounds. You can see in the later rounds, he got me. We were in close, and he just went in on the body like three or four shots, like boom, 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 boom. You know, and you know, even in the fight, Nazim, I have a trainer. I have a great trainer. And he basically tells you how the fight's going to go. And he says, you know, Steve, once you continue to box him and move him and hit him with that jab and drop these big shots on him, he's going to only do one thing, and that's try to get you in the last 10 seconds of each round. And surely that's what he tried there. And he said, he's going to try to slow you down in the later rounds by going to your body. And sure enough, he tried to go to my body in the end, but it wasn't, you know, it was too late.
Right, right.
And I hate to ever compare myself to a pro, but when I was an amateur boxer, that's all I ever did. But I watched a little of that fight. I didn't see the whole thing, but when I started watching it, I just was thinking, geez, you know, he's fighting just like I used to like to fight. You know, you get into a defensive mode, and you wait for that guy to make a mistake, and you lead with jab. And you kept that jab right in his face through that whole fight. And every article I read was he controlled the jab. And the one fight I won in nationals when I was an amateur, the judge came up to me after the fight, and he told me that the jab was what won you that fight. So I couldn't for the life of me figure out, with a jab like that, how any judge could score it against you.
Now, see, that's one of the things that I've been saying, man. And I'm going to keep saying it until we see something different. Or something happens. But the thing is, I'm like, either, like I said before, either the judges just, they were on the take and they already had round scores for Adamek from the beginning, even before we started fighting, or they don't know how to score a fight. They don't know how to score. score a jab. They obviously weren't scoring my jab. You know, they obviously, these judges, I don't understand the curriculum for judges. You know, because it seems if a guy is just walking at you, he gets to win the round. You know, not effectively punching you, or but eating shots, and he's just, him just coming in to come into you, you know, that wins you a round. And it's ridiculous. I'm actively using my jab all round, keeping him off me, attacking him with the jab. The jab was just doing everything for me that night.
And defense, well, you counted yourself too, and you had your hands up through a lot of that fight, and you were
exactly. I always thought it was four things.
Yeah, I mean, I thought we had effective aggression and ring generalship, defense, and clean, effective punching, okay?
Exactly.
And they're all supposed to be equal. Now, if you take all four of those into consideration, like you said, they were either bribed or incompetent, or maybe their glasses needed adjusted. I don't know. You figure it out. Go from there. But that's the fight most of us seen.
Nope. I just don't. Let me set this straight. I can say that I'm over it. Not completely over. You know, getting cheated like that. You never get over that. But just I'm ready to move on. And there's really nothing I can do. You know, so me being angry and or just harping on it really hurts me. So, and I've been here before. You know, I've been cheated. I lost my first fight ever. You know, I lost my undefeated record to a robbery in Poland. So I've been here before, and we know how to bounce back from this. But I still question, like, how this can happen. What's going to stop it from happening to future fighters, or what's going to stop it from happening to me in the future, because I'm not finished. And what do they score fights on now? Because obviously the rules have changed. You know, ring generalship, landed punches, effective aggressiveness. I mean, that's what I thought they scored fights on. So, if you like you just said, I controlled the ring with my movement. The name of the game is boxing. The name of it isn't slugging. It isn't power punching. You know, but it seems the guy who throws the heavier shots, he gets more credit than the guy who can tame himself from going to becoming a wild man, a guy who can tame himself to throw jabs under fire while you got this monster trying to come in and knock your head off. Now, and don't forget, this dude was 20 pounds heavier than me, and he's been a heavyweight way longer than me. So, I mean, what are these judges scoring on? That's what I need a memo mailed to my home or something to let me know.
It's supposed to be the sweet science, right?
Exactly.
The sweet science, not the sweet brawl, not the sweet street fight.
Exactly. I mean, it's ridiculous.
After the Bradley fight with Pacquiao, my suggestion was they ought to be able to give these judges the CompuStat numbers after every round so that they know what they're basing their decision on. Not just what they saw, because the guys miss a lot. I mean, look at where they're sitting. They're sitting way down, right next to the ring. But they're sitting down almost on the ground looking up. And they're looking through ropes. So why not give them some concrete figures to work with?
Yeah. They even need higher chairs, or there needs to be more judges. There needs to be at least five judges. Something, because like you said, you got judges who are basically under the last rope, and I've got pictures of the fight, and almost every picture of the fight, you can see the female judge. I forgot her name, but you can see her like bending under these ropes, trying to see what's going on, like she cares, you know, because she obviously, you know, scored the fight, you know, scored these rounds that I blatantly won for Adamic. But I mean, then it goes into a popularity thing. I mean, it's just ridiculous, man. It's mind-boggling to me, man. I still scratch my head, man.
Well, Steve, the question I wanted to ask you was, and I noticed this in the fight, with you fighting a couple of your fights overseas in Germany, you know, you weren't getting a large, you know, American-based audience. But obviously I followed a lot of your fights online. And doing so, I wanted to ask you this. Moving up to heavyweight, even though it was only, it looks like from some of your previous fights, only about a total of about maybe 7 to 8 pounds, did you feel a lot stronger? And the reason I ask, some of the fights where you had suffered flash knockdowns, and I even remember saying, I said, I don't know if the losing any of the weight to get under 200 might have affected the strength in your legs. I know that happened to me when I was fighting in the amateurs. You seemed so much stronger, and you seemed your legs seemed so much more spry in the fight 2 weeks ago.
Well, let me tell you guys, when I fought at cruiserweight, I never, I was a very small cruiserweight. My muscles make me look bigger, but I never touched 200. When I weighed in at the last Hernandez fight, I was 200, and my last cruiserweight fight, I was 199. But I would go to the scales with a gallon of water, drinking water, just trying to appear heavier, on the scales. I would leave the gym as a cruiserweight at like 193, 194, 195 someday. I mean, like 94, 93. I'm leaving the gym. And the thing was, I was just a small cruiserweight, and I worked. My work ethic, man, I was working out like I was, Marquez trying to make 130 or something. I always ran, swam, sprints. I always was doing something. Like every day, man, I had to do something. That was just a mental thing with me. So, even when I didn't have a fight, I was working out hard. So when I decided to go heavyweight, and my trainer also mentioned it, and I thought it also, I was saying maybe these few extra pounds, which turned out to be about 11 pounds, because my first heavyweight fight, I was 207, but if you look at my last cruiserweight fight, I was like 198 or something, but really, that was after drinking half a gallon of water. I was literally like 195, so I put on like 10 solid pounds. And he also said that extra weight will possibly help me sustain these shots and avoid these flash knockdowns.
Yeah. I mean, that was things. I remember, like, early in my career, I did, like, sometimes drastic weight cuts, and I fought smaller guys, and I suffered flash knockdowns. Then when I moved up and I was fighting guys at heavyweight, I'm talking about from 165 to heavyweight, at 165 and 172, heavyweight, no problems, 190 and above. And that's what I was seeing to think, it was just the cutting of the weight that just affected, my strength and my durability.
And truthfully, I feel so much stronger. I mean, when I fought as a cruiserweight, after the fight, I would be so drained and so just spun.
Right.
After my first fight at heavyweight, and I went a solid 10 rounds with Jason Gavin, a tough guy, and I was throwing a lot of punches. I felt great. I mean, I didn't have that drain feeling. I felt awesome. Like, I mean, you can ask my family and my team. I just kept mentioning how great I felt, man. And I felt so comfortable at that weight, 207, 208. I want to get to exactly 210 pounds, and just see how I feel there and stay there. I don't want to get any bigger because you don't need to. The extra weight doesn't necessarily mean you're a better fighter. So but I felt great.
Look at the great Joe Frazier. He was usually only around 208 himself.
Yep, exactly. So, but for this fight with Tomas, I came in at 203, and I mean, it's solely, and I make no excuses, but I mean, it's just solely, and I have no excuses. I performed my butt off, but I had a stomach virus. I caught a cold and a stomach virus from my kids Tuesday before we fought, and Tuesday we didn't even go to the gym. So we drove up to the venue Thursday, the day of the press conference, and I still, stomach viruses don't go away. I was in the bathroom all week. So I would have came in about 208, 209 for this fight, but it's just that virus kicked my butt, and I just couldn't hold nothing in. And, I mean, but I felt like this fight had to happen now. It was one of those things. Like, I mean, I fought in Germany with the flu. And I beat the guy. So once you do something like that, a little stomach virus is not going to stop you from fighting.
Well, of course, everybody's probably going to want to know the answer to the question, will there be a
third fight between you guys? Are you trying to negotiate that? Is he open to it? Do you know anything along those lines?
Well, no, we're waiting for a promoter. We're going to talk with them, I think, within the week and see what's going on for next. But, I mean, me personally, after the first Adam fight, I had an axe to grind. You know, it really wasn't even an axe to grind. I felt he beat me. You know, it was one of them things. I did the best I could. He beat me. Hats off to him. He did his job. I didn't do my job. I wanted another opportunity against this same opponent to show I can do my job. And I did that. That's why I feel I did in the second round. Actually, I think I did even better than I imagined, almost better than I imagined, without a knockdown or knockout. But my thirst has been quenched. I mean, I'd fight him if HBO or if they wanted to do it in the money, because the money for this fight wasn't at all what anybody thinks. This was a straight-up opportunity fight. But and I took it. You know, that's what you have to do in boxing sometimes. And I took it. And knowing we would win and move on to a bigger payday to compensate for what we missed on fighting him the second time. But, my thirst is quenched against Adamic. I mean, I think, truthfully, if he fights Pulev, he gets put to sleep and or really beat bad. I mean, he takes some shots. I mean, even Vitaly couldn't even, you know, they had to stop the fight. He'd have still been taking punches. Yeah. He takes too many shots. He's so hittable. I fear for his life after boxing.
Nice.
I remember when we were getting ready to watch the fight at our little camper a few weeks ago when we were sawing our Christmas trees. I remember talking to the two guys there. One of them was a friend of mine that I grew up with. Another is a gentleman that I work with there. So they both sat in there. And I get to feel like I'm with the expert to these guys because they asked me all these questions. And the first thing I did to impress them was the referee of the fight, Gary Rosado. I've known for 20 years. Because he started the boxing program at my alma mater, Lock Haven, and he sent me a Christmas card 2 days before the fight. So that was my first thing to impress these guys. I got a Christmas card from the referee. But then we were watching the fight, and I was sitting there talking to him. That was the first thing I said to him. I said, a guy like Adamac is just too easy to hit. And the only thing that saves him is his chin. The guy's got a great chin. There was, I forget if it was the sixth or the eighth round, the short right hand that you caught him with, it was a counter shot over his jab. And they even looked at me when that punch landed, and they said, how did he not go down from that? And I said, I just told you, the guy's got a great chin, and he depends on it too much.
Yeah.
It's like his last line of defense.
Yeah, my trainer, you know, Nazim, he studies fighters, he studies them to the T. He basically said, that's Adamic's only defense. I mean, that's why he's so hittable, that his chin is his defense, and that's how he beats guys. He beats guys with his chin. He suckers you in to hitting him, and you're right there for his counter. Look at the Travis Walker fight. Look at the knockdowns that he got me with in my fight. You know, you get suckered into thinking you can knock him out, and you keep going, and you keep going, and you're right there, boop, and he gets you.
Well, I remember, like I said, the fourth round of that first fight, you had him on the ropes, you hit him with about maybe six or eight uppercuts.
Yeah.
And then he countered off that, and he landed that one flush punch. But I also remember in the 12th round, when you were trying to close the show, and you hit him with a couple straight right hands, and it was actually picking his lead foot up. And I said, this guy's about to go down. He has to go down. Nobody can stand up to the flush punches he's taken. And amazingly, the guy didn't. Now, the other question I was going to ask you, as you were mentioning, Nazim Richardson, who's your trainer. I met Nazim for the first time. I think I was 18 or 19. He was down. They had a rec center showing down at Happy Hollow. And I was going down there because some of my friends from Marion Anderson were fighting Yannis. So I went down there to, you know, root some of my guys on. I was home from college that weekend, so I went down there to root some of my guys on. And he was down there with all his little boys, the Allen boys, when they were only about 12 years old. So I've got to follow Nazim when he wasn't even Bernard Hopkins' head trainer. He was just, you know, his secondary trainer. And I always felt his strength was strategizing against a very aggressive fighter. And I noticed it in Hopkins' fights with Trinidad and Kelly Pavlik. I really... And John Pascal, who we just beat a year or two ago, I noticed it when he had Shane Mosley against Antonio Margarito. And once again, 2 weeks ago, I felt he just set up a great game plan against Adamack. And I said, that's the guy, that's his best strength, is strategizing against a very face-forward type of opponent.
Yeah. I mean, you got, like I said, when you got a guy like Adamack with just simply power and who uses his chin as his defense, what's he going to do? He's not going to stay out on the outside with you. You know, he's coming in. He's coming in to land big shots, and that's all he can do. His jab is a normal jab. It's a mediocre jab. His footwork is he's got a European style. I mean, he, like I said, this is the same Adamack I fought in 08. You know, he's the same. I mean, once you put a jab and speed and movement on a guy like that, they're shut down.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well. Let's move on.
Oh, yeah, I want to change gears a little bit. A couple topics I wanted to talk to you about, because I'm a fellow Philadelphian. So I followed you when they did a story on you on Action News a couple years ago, and they also recently had an article on you, and I believe it was like Sports Week. They talk about your daughter Unity with some of the struggles she had early in her life. And then also, I remember discussing with you a couple of years ago some of the role model work that you try to do for, young guys, inner city guys. So I just wanted you to talk on those topics.
Oh, well, the situation with my daughter, for those who don't know, my daughter was born with a heart disease called lipoplastic left heart syndrome. Basically means she was born without the left side of her heart. And she needs 3 surgeries to correct it or fix it. So she's already had the first surgery when she was actually 3 days old, and the next surgery in 6 months. And the third surgery we haven't had yet. We're in a rough patch right now. They're saying she may need a transplant. She may or may not, but they're looking a little more towards May. We're praying that she doesn't, and we got some more tests to go. But, she's 7 years old now. Her name's Kennedy. And, we've just been asking everybody to pray. I had my daughter, she was born days after I beat Kelvin Davis, for the IBF number one spot in Cleveland. And we came home and my wife got induced that week. And, it's just been, that's helped our family grow closer. It's helped our faith grow even stronger. And it just, gives you more meaning, more drive to life. I'm 100%, 100,000% family man, my family is my everything for me, under God.
Well, that's awesome that, you guys are, putting that effort in. And, it's good to hear an interesting story for sure. That's,
I remember talking to you. I remember talking to you a couple of years ago. We met Alhambra down at the fight card the one night. I talked for you for a few minutes, you and your wife. And then we did the interview just a matter of weeks later. On our website. And I remember another thing we were talking about, as I just mentioned, some of the role models that you like to do for the young guys in the city, especially some of the inner city youth that are tempted to go towards the wrong path. And two of the guys that we talked about, a couple pro fighters, they were the Mitchell twin brothers, and how they had the nicknames Murder and Homicide. And that's one thing we aren't even saying on the air, that that's just not a good thing to promote. That's a bad thing. We're in a city that's having 300 and some murders a year, and you don't want to promote that. You want to promote, put down the guns and put on the gloves, good things. I remember I wasn't at the gym that night down at Marian Anderson, but there was the one trainer down there who recently passed away, Jimmy Arthur, and they were mad at him about something, and they were going to go out and get a gun and come back to the gym.
Thankfully,
they were stopped.
I mean, you got guys out there who still had his mindset. I mean, people, they had his mindset. It's like the Wild Wild West of a lot of people out here, and that's why we have a lot of murders. You can blame music. You can't blame music by itself because, you know, I mean, if you go into the movie store, to, you know, Blockbuster or Netflix, and you look at almost, I say, 80% of the movie covers, somebody's got a gun in their hand or, you know, it's about killing. You go to the toy store.
It shows. There's violence in it.
Yeah, you go to the toy store, and even all the toys geared to our kids, that's dealing with military, somebody shooting somebody blowing somebody up. I mean, video games, it's everything. It's not just one thing. You know, so we're training our kids on how to do this stuff from when they're small. And then, you know, everybody asks, well, how is it like this? I mean, we need to shelter our kids a lot more if that's the main problem. So, I mean, guys like the Mitchell Twins, like you said, I wouldn't take a name like that. I mean, you know, they got their preference. I wouldn't take a name like that just because of what you said. I just don't like the things that are associated with it. I mean, this is boxing. It's a business, and that's where the business side comes in. You want to be marketable, you know. Guys wonder why they're not doing interviews on ESPN or why they're not hosting, you know, certain boxing events or HBO doesn't have them. It's because it's attitude. It's everything that comes with you. So you have to be marketable. I mean, and I'm gonna go to the race thing right here, right quick. But I mean, African Americans, we have a bad look. You know, I mean, be it the news or ourselves. You know, we're the only ones in each country. I mean, in each city, major city, we're the ones with the high homicide rate. We're killing each other, so we got a bad look, and we need to. Something needs to be done to make it not look so bad. So, my thing is, that's why I like working down at the Rock Ministry of Philadelphia because you've got black, white, Latino. Asian, everybody comes down there, but they get chance to see. These are kids from probably one of the worst neighborhoods in America, but they get chance to come in box, have Bible study. It's just a big rec center indoors, and they get chance to see a two-time world champ. You know, I mean, how amazing is that for a kid to just come in off the street and talk to, and I'm not that big, but, you know, still a two-time world champ, anybody. You know, if Roy Jones was at my rec center when I was a kid, who knows what word he would have said to me to encourage me or set me on a right path or a different path. So I feel it's my duty as an African-American, as a man, as a father, as a Christian, as a world champion to not just, you know, give back. It's just so it's weak to me. It's just be there, you know, be part of your community to help, to support your community, the good in your community. And like I said, and me being an African American, if I can stereotype some other way by these kids meeting me and not, you know, not murder a homicider over here, then so be it. You know, I'll steer them in this way. That's not what every African American is about. You know, I've been to numerous states, been to numerous schools, numerous, you know, talking at churches and Bible studies. But one thing that I notice is people who aren't raised around African Americans, you know, you have these kids that, or people, it's not just kids, but they're adults too, who affiliate every African American with hip hop. You know, so guys are coming meet and greet me with a phony fake or something that they seen on MTV. Yo, what's up, dog? And you know, it's like, come on, dude. We know you don't just talk like that. You don't have to come at me like that. Just a normal hello is cool. Like, come on, too much MTV, man. Too much BET. You know, just relax. So when they meet a guy like me, me knowing all these things, I had these things in mind, it makes me want to be a certain way to impress on them. Like, yo, that's not the view of every black person, you know. So it's a lot, you know. It's a duty to me, you know. I believe that's what should happen. That's what everyone should do. Every athlete. I mean, we're looked upon as we're stars, you know. And in people's minds, and we know people get real fanatical, you know. Some of these athletes are like gods to people, you know. So with that much influence, you gotta do right by it.
Well, Steve, we just got our 60-second warning. Is there any final thoughts you want to give, any shout-outs before we go?
No, I'm very happy that people got to see me, you know, America's got to see me on television. here in America, but I'm not happy with the what happened with the outcome. But I'm moving on, and life does go on, and there's not too much I can do, but keep on fighting and try to be champion again.
Steve, my crystal ball, my crystal ball sees a lot of good wins coming up. You keep punching.
Oh man, thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, well, thanks a lot, Steve, and we'd love to be on another game in the future. I wish we could have talked more about some better highlights of your career. we got a lot. Thanks for taking the time.
All right, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, man. Talk to you, guys.
Adios, folks. All right. Thanks for stopping by.